Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting faith with life.
Hello and welcome to Connecting Faith. Really looking forward to a conversation today as we talk about origins and some of the ongoing debate that seems to get stronger and stronger as it relates to intelligent design creation versus evolution. I have a couple of guests in the studio, and we're going to jump right in and give them the full hour. And I know that it may spur some questions that you might have as well. And so we'll make sure we give a website here shortly where you can go to find some more information. But happy to welcome Walter Remine. Walter is has a degree in electrical engineering from the University of Minnesota, and he's worked in mathematical fields of signal processing and pattern recognition, where he holds 4 patents. He has also just become very knowledgeable in the area of evolution, particularly the maybe the arguments that evolutionists use to support their claims, and we're going to hear more from Walter in a moment as well. And then Dr. Bruce Samatt. Bruce is Associate Professor of Biology at the University of Northwestern, where Faith Radio originates, and has been here for a number of years and has a PhD from the University of Minnesota and one of our great teachers on campus, and we're looking forward to having a good conversation together. So, Bruce and Walter, welcome. Thanks for coming.
Hi, thank you.
You know, maybe by way of just kind of introduction, we can say a word. Walter, maybe I'll just start with you to talk about how you got intrigued and interested in exposing some of what's going on in evolution and sort of getting into the debate.
Well, I got interested back in college. That was so many years ago now. I don't want to say how many. It was back in the early 70s. And Dwayne Gish and Henry Morris were coming out with their creation material at that time. And for personal reasons, I got interested in just getting to the bottom of it all, one way or the other. It just became important, and picked up some of their books and found it intriguing at the time. The creation movement, of course, has been through a lot of changes since then, grown quite a bit, gotten more sophisticated in its arguments, but they gave me a very good start back then.
Bruce, for you, you always wanted to be a professor and teach biology, or kind of a little bit about your story?
Oh, no. By the time I finished my master's and PhD, I said, this is a quote, I'll never teach. I got seduced to the other side of the coin, if you will, into research. I spent 12 years in research with 3 different biotech companies. And then had a change of heart, a real epiphany of where I belonged for the rest of my life. And though I was trying to listen to God and said, I'll follow wherever you lead me. First it was if the compensation package is similar, sure. But then again I abandoned that eventually and ended up wanting to come to Northwestern. In fact, when I started here 21 years ago, it was an associate degree in science, and they hired me to make it a bachelor's degree in biology. So it's 21 years, starting 22, and there's no place I'd rather be.
Oh, well, glad to have you here and glad to have you part of the conversation today. Because, you know, maybe it would be good to say some words about the kind of definitions. I mean, one of the things we're going to be talking about is maybe effective arguments that we can use in the support of creation. You know, lots of debate going on about that, and we were just talking before the program that, you know, there was a anniversary not long ago about Scopes monkey trial, and, you know, Walters, you said there's been a lot of changes in just the both sides, I guess, over the last 20, 30 years. What are we talking about when we talk about evolution? You know, it is a theory, although you wouldn't know that, I guess, from today's probably higher education and in science field, right?
Well, you were talking about definitions. One of the points I make all the time is that almost all the keywords of the origins debate have been misdefined in favor of evolutionists and to the disfavor of their opponents. A classic example is the word evolution. They define it as change over time, change in gene frequencies, things like that, and that isn't how it's defined in this debate. No. You have to stomp on that right away because that concept, that definition has been misused by them so much. Evolution in this debate is all the way from rocks to rock stars, and anything less is creation. That's what they have to argue for, all the way from rocks to rock stars. It's not just change over time or change in gene frequencies. That's one example, but really virtually all the other keywords have been misdefined too for their favor in the disfavor of creationists.
Almost no room at all for even a hint of intelligent design. Right?
So. No, in fact, that has to be ruled out by them. Otherwise, it is a foot in the door, and they will not have that. The definitions, as Walter was referring to, change over time. Just about everybody can agree with that. It's genetic diversity. And we can actually push that. We do that with dogs, mm-hmm. our favorite pet. And we try to push the genetic resiliency and the genetic diversity by breeding, doing selective breeding. So we make the very little poodle, and then we make the Great Dane. And then we find that when you inbreed too much, you end up with a lot of problems. So nature has to be diverse. It cannot be selecting as natural selection is defined, which is another definition of evolution, that natural selection can be creative and give you new kinds. Natural selection can be useful for an immediate idea. Something might be a little bit more useful right now, but when the temperature changes, when the environment changes, that can become not so useful. So you have to extrapolate like crazy to give natural selection any kind of creative power. Another definition is that everything has the universal common descent from one organism. They're trying to find that via fossils. Well, now you have to stretch the fossil record everywhere to try to find a universal common descent yeah. organism. So they have to handle the problems by defining and giving definitions that exclude any other thoughts.
Well, we're going to enter... invite some other thoughts in our conversation today.
Right.
And I guess, you know, one of the first questions I had, Walter and Bruce, as we were thinking about this conversation was, and I know, Walter, you've done a lot of writing and work on the whole area of finding, using evolutionists' own sort of words to, deal with the arguments. But is there one area of, a procreation evidence or support that's most troubling for the evolutionists?
I could name several.
Okay.
I think.
Well, you pick a couple. We've got time.
The origin of life. The creationists own that issue now. The evidence really, really is in their favor. They have a scientific theory. Evolutionists don't have a scientific theory. I'd say creationists own the cosmology issues. That whole field. Evolutionists are desperate to explain what we see, and they have gone so far as to invoke. Multi-universes, an infinitude of other universes unlike our own. Very unscientific idea, but that's how far they've been driven out of the world of science in order to try and answer the questions. I'd also throw in issues of genetics, population genetics. Creationists now have developed, a team of creationists under Dr. John Sanford, Ph.D., geneticist. He's worked his whole career in evolutionary genetics. He was an evolutionist for his whole career. And he led a team of us creationists to develop the world's most accurate computer simulation of population genetics. And that computer simulation, if you plug in reasonable values for mutation rates and reproduction rates, gives you very unevolutionary results. It shows that evolution goes downward, not upward, at least using current models of evolution, current understanding of how evolution works. At any rate, I would start off with those three areas,
yeah.
The universe, the origin of life, and genetics.
Bruce, I don't know if there's anything you want to add to that. But just,
One thing that in my teaching of developmental biology, when it's conception to birth, essentially that's what the course is. What we don't understand is once we have figured out the genetic code, which the Human Genome Project is still defining, but they have come a long way to find out where the genes are, what the genes might be making. But what we're finding is that any one gene can make dozens, even hundreds, and now recently thousands of different proteins. It is so versatile. We don't know who's in control of the genes. It used to be taught when I went to school, all the way through, until, in fact, till last several years ago, it was taught one gene made one protein. But then they started finding out that if there's about 23,000 genes, well, then there should be about 23,000 proteins. Well, add a zero. Mm-hmm. We're over around 230,000 proteins. How do that small number of genes make that many proteins? Something's in control. Now, that's magnified. That control is magnified out of our imagination when you start looking at developmental biology, when every one of us started as a conceived egg. And so now here's one cell, and now that cell is going to become every kind of cell and end up in the right place and function properly. That's not under so much genetic control. It is something else is controlling the genes, when to express, when not to express, how much, when to slow down, when to speed up. So it's developmental biology that evolutionists are trying to break in. They call it evo-devo, evolutionary development, and it's just filled with speculations because there's no way they can come up with data showing sure dumb luck can make a creature from one egg, from a fertilized egg. So that's another whole area of controlling the genes, and especially during embryonic development.
That's one of the questions I know, Walter, you addressed, right? It's what the evolutionist says, it's all happened by chemistry, right? How did life, with the specifications for hundreds of proteins, originate just by chemistry?
That's a huge problem for them. As I was saying, the origin of life. Yeah. Only 200 years ago, church leaders like Thomas Aquinas and many scientists, most scientists, believed in spontaneous generation, that higher life forms just spontaneously generated. Mice, toads, frogs, I guess, sprung forth from nothing. Now, today, just 200 years later, we've made tremendous progress towards creation. Creationists have made huge progress in this area, and we know that nothing like any known life form could have formed naturalistically.
I mean, nothing. That's
nothing. Nothing like known life form. And what they're claiming, what evolutionists are now claiming, is that the first life form was nothing like any known life form. Nothing. Yet they existed on this planet. So the next thing we ask is, where are those life forms? Where are they? Yeah. Where are all these other life forms that evolutionists claim existed? We can't find them. So this is two strikes already against evolutionists. They can't show the origin of life. They claim that other life forms existed. We can't find those either. You follow the dilemma they're in?
Yeah.
They are having problems explaining even the simplest parts. Parts of the simplest organism, not just explaining the simplest organism. They can't even explain the simplest parts of the simplest organism, how those parts would form naturalistically. As I say, the creationists own the origin of life issue. It's a very strong argument in their favor.
And to build on that, whenever a protein is made in the cell, it is then has so many other functions, functional units, organelles in the cell that modify the protein and bring it to the right place. And a cell cannot live without all this. It takes a village to make a protein and make it right and make it happen in the right place. And then and these proteins are off almost always. They are inhibited from being active where they're made. And when they finally follow a little track that literally acts like a monorail and brings it to the right place in the cell, then the protein is further modified, so now it's active. Because if it was active earlier, it would be a loose cannon, and it would not do its job where it needed its job to be done. So it's so complicated, and they completely brush over these things and say, well, that could, quote, that could easily have come from this, and that could easily have changed from that. There's no such thing as easy in a cell.
We're talking today with Walter Remine, who is an engineer and has worked a great deal. His book is called The Biotic Message, been well-received for its novel insights and arguments against evolutionary theory. And Dr. Bruce Samatt, who is Associate Professor of Biology here at the University of Northwestern. And we're going to talk more in just a moment as we talk creation and evolution. You're listening to Connecting Faith. You're listening to Connecting Faith. Glad to have you connected in today as we talk with electrical engineer and mathematician and insightful author and scholar, Walter Amine. Walter has written a book called The Biotic Message. We'll find out, give him a chance to talk a little bit more about the website where you can go for information on issues of creation science and arguments against evolution. Dr. Bruce Samant is a professor, associate professor of biology at the University of Northwestern. We're talking today about some of what's happening in the debate about creation and evolution. And Walter has done a great deal of study and sort of taking the evolutionists' arguments back to them. And Walter, you've been doing this for a number of years. I mean, it has changed a lot, hasn't it, over the years? And
yes.
We were just talking before the program a little bit about even the fossil record is a key area.
Yes, yes. There's a group I call the Classical Darwinists. The Classical Darwinists, for over 100 years, argued that they could identify the ancestors, and they tried very hard to identify the ancestors, give them names, and so forth. And that whole program of research collapsed in the mid-1970s. Collapsed not totally, but it fell out of disfavor with evolutionists. And it was replaced by a rather different group or view of how to deal with the evidence. Now, today, evolutionists approach it this way. They avoid identifying the ancestors. They can't identify them. They can't find them. The ancestors don't exist, whatever. But the evolutionists will avoid identifying the ancestors. And there's a very simple reason for that. If they try and name an ancestor, an actual ancestor that you can hold in your hands, for example, a fossil, they immediately get into arguments with other evolutionists. Other evolutionists will disagree. They don't agree on the ancestor, it's not clear. It's not clear if the ancestors exist at all. And so today, these days, evolutionists avoid identifying the ancestors. They'll avoid giving it a name, naming one. They will instead speak of sibling species and cousin species and a hypothetical common ancestor, but they won't identify the ancestor. And that is crucial to understanding where evolutionists are today. I'll give you an example. When they don't identify the ancestors, then any fossil sequence is okay. Any fossil sequence is compatible with evolution. See, evolution predicts that the ancestors should occur before the descendants, but if they never identify the ancestors, then any fossil sequence is okay with evolution. Okay.
So do fossils still have significance and weight among evolutionists?
The fossils still have evidence for
they're still useful for an evolutionist?
They think so.
Okay.
They think so. They think that evolution, since evolution is a fact, they don't have to they don't have to prove it anymore. And so
sure.
They just have to explain it. And they will, so all the fossils are certainly interesting to them, and they pursue explanations of them. They're not testable explanations, but they don't have the evidence for this wholesale transformation of life anymore. I think that the evolutionary theory has imploded today from what it used to be. At least it used to be back in the day, the classical Darwinists had a testable research program. There was evidence for it or conceivably evidence against it. That's not how they play the game anymore. Today's version of evolutionary theory is unrisky, untestable, unfalsifiable. In other words, it's not science.
To build on that, what has happened in our textbooks, as I'm teaching especially principles of biology to freshmen, the chapters on evolution use terms. They make terms up so that they don't have to do testability to see if would this actually hold up under scrutiny. So when you find fossils that are not the same, they call it divergence. And then when you find different groups that have similar structures, well, then they call it convergence. Mm-hmm. And then that's all it is. It's you see convergence happened, or you see divergence happened. Well, what is that? How did that happen? There's no mechanism. It's just a term. So what I have done, my whole impetus here was when I started 20 years ago at Northwestern, I didn't ever, up to that point, have to deal with evolution. The companies that I worked for, biotech companies, nobody cared about evolution because it was irrelevant to getting the job done. We're doing cutting-edge science with immunology and blood tests for the hospital market. And evolution is a historical rendition of how things might have happened. So it has no relevance. So nobody ever mentioned it, ever. In 15 years, they never talk about it. So I come here, and all of a sudden I am opening up a freshman textbook, and I have to teach that this is really important. Mm-hmm. Well, it's not important. Mm-hmm. It never. You don't need to know that for a job, unless, of course, you want a job in evolution. Mm-hmm. Other than that, probably not. Mm-hmm. So what has happened then in the textbooks is that they're trying to show some relevance, that this is important. Well, it's not important to do your job today. But in understanding us and where we've come from, that's where they try to make it important. So to that end, I found a small book written by people who work for the Discovery Institute, specifically Stephen Meyer, and their arguments for and arguments against neo-Darwinism. And neo, in this case, of course, means the new Darwinism, because things have changed so much from Darwin's original treatise of what evolution should be. So I use this small little paperback book, and I have the students read an actual scientific rendition of what is actually the evidence. Then we get into the chapters in the textbook where they don't worry about the evidence. They just worry about telling you what it should mean. See, what it should mean. So in reflecting on what Walter just said about the fossil record, there have been numerous papers that have shown that the fossil record doesn't follow Darwinian common origin descent, and that all the branches that come off are contrived and actually written in without any intermediates. But what the fossil record really looks like is that once an organism is established on this earth, once an organism shows up fossil-wise on this earth, it hardly changes at all. In other words, there could be, quote, some diversity, but not very much, which comes under the microevolution concept. But that's the diversity part. So, but they don't, stasis, as it's called, the lack of change is the norm for all of the fossil record, not change into new body plants.
We're talking today with Walter Amein and Dr. Bruce Samant. Bruce is associate professor of biology. Walter's electrical engineer, mathematician, and he is working in the area of supporting creation science and using some of the evolutionist arguments against it. We're going to take a quick break and come back and talk a little bit more, and we want to make sure we mention Walter, the website where you can find out more about some of his writings as we continue to look at design and evolution and the battle between the two. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm Niels Dave. To Connecting Faith, and appreciate the opportunity to spend some time today as we talk about some pretty primary, fundamental, important issues. We're talking about origins and about God's design and his act of work in creation. Of course, there is a theory that rules the day, it seems, the theory of evolution, which has sort of all the press and maybe all the, well, I don't know if it has all the press, but it's in the textbooks. So how do we combat evolution? How do we look at some of the arguments? And as we've been talking about today, we've discovered that there's a lot of holes in almost wherever you poke in the theory of evolution, some big holes there. As someone who's been poking holes for a long time in that area, Walter Remine. Walter, maybe before we go on, just to identify the website, stpaulscience.com, what are people going to find there?
They'll find my book and some of my writings. They can see how to get my book. My book dismantles evolutionary theory. Yeah. It's like a college textbook, so it's not light reading, but it also offers a theory to replace evolution, yeah. A testable theory, right. A theory that it predicts all the major patterns of life, predicts what we should find, what we shouldn't find, and I'm still thrilled about it. and evolutionists don't want to talk about it.
Well, I want to pick up on that again. Just want to reintroduce Dr. Bruce Samatt, the Associate Professor of Biology, with Walter today. Bruce is here at the University of Northwestern. So we're talking evolution and creation. And as you said, Walter, evolutionists don't want to talk about this. Is that kind of how they deal with the creation viewpoint today?
For decades, evolutionists really don't address creationist stuff until they have to. Until somebody passes a law somewhere saying they're going to teach creation in schools, and then suddenly evolutionists find their tongues and start addressing the issues. They didn't address it at all, the creationist material, until in the 1980 when creationists in Arkansas passed a law to teach creation science. And then there was a trial, and then it lays low for a while. Evolutionists don't talk about creationist stuff until another law is passed. And so what evolutionists are doing is using the courts to try and settle scientific issues. They're using a judge somewhere to try and settle scientific issues. I don't know any scientist anywhere who would agree with that as a way of settling scientific issues. This is wrong, okay? Yet that's what they do. They also, evolutionists today, for decades, have been going, if you don't publish in our peer-reviewed journals, then we don't have to pay attention to you. And, oh, by the way, we're not going to let you publish in our evolutionist-controlled peer-reviewed journals. So they don't feel they have to address what creationists are saying. So for decades, the pattern has been like this. Evolutionists encourage each other to not debate the creationists. We have them on record saying that many times. When they do debate the creationists, it's usually oral. It's usually a public debate somewhere, and it's oral, and it's not, and you'd have no record of it, basically. So it's as if the event never happened in terms of doing research. Okay, and the third leg of their approach is when creationists have books and they try and get them into libraries somewhere, like a public library or a high school library, evolutionists fight and generally fight successfully to keep creationist books out of the libraries. It's amazing. Just go to your public library and try and find some books on creation science. You won't find it. Okay? Now, I say that's wrong on all levels. All three legs of that are wrong, wrong, wrong. Evolutionists should actively debate their opponents. In fact, this is the way I put it. In order to have a monopoly on the public schools, they must debate their opponents outside of school. Okay? And let me boil that down to something simpler. Let's say somebody wants to teach some peculiar view of Jewish history during World War II, for example. You know what I'm talking about, okay? They have to debate their opponents outside of school. Yeah. If there's some substantial opposition to it, they have to debate it outside of school. That's what I'm concerned about, is that evolutionists don't do that. And because of that, there's errors that have been in textbooks for decades that evolutionists know are wrong. The evolutionary leaders know they're wrong, and yet they're taught in the textbooks, they're taught in public schools for decades. Creationists are shouting about it, saying, no, no, this is wrong, and evolutionists don't discuss it. They just keep on teaching it for decades after they know it's wrong. And that, again, is not how science or education should work. We need more openness. We need more debate outside of public school. I think creationists can win that debate if evolutionists will ever engage. I think creationists can win it. And what people out there, people listening today, what they can do is one simple thing, put pressure on evolutionists to address the issues, do it in writing, do it publicly, make both sides of that debate widely available in libraries where you can find it. I'll give you an example. You can find Adolf Hitler's book in the libraries. You can find it in the libraries. And it's important. Repository for all our huge debates. Where libraries should have these kinds of things. Yet you won't find the creation debate represented in public libraries or school libraries, right? Yeah. And I say that's wrong. To make headway in this whole thing, we need some openness. We need to have these debate recorded in writing, widely available in libraries, where people can cite it and reference it, and people out there should push for that. Push evolutionists to engage and not use the courts to settle this issue.
Actually, and they say it's very hard to get that to happen, hardly if ever. Where it did get engaged, and it took a huge effort, was in Kansas in 2005, where enough members of the State Board of Education were concerned about teaching evolution kindergarten through 12th grade without the substantial background of evidence. So, and especially they were just looking at origins. That's all they were saying is there is no science for origins. It's just pure speculation, but it's the only thing that's allowed to be taught. So at that time, an effort was made to have a debate about origins in Topeka, Kansas, and it finally did happen. And in 2005, a group was put together to testify about origins, the biochemistry, the physiology, the embryology, everything about how would we actually get a cell, first of all, much less an embryo after that. See, how do you get, that's even a second question, but how do you get a cell? How do you get life? I was asked to testify there, and there were 22 others, I think there were 23 of us from around the country that testified. And in 1 week, 23 of us testified showing that there is no biochemistry, there is no evidence of life starting from nothing, abiotic becoming biotic, essentially. The next week, the opposition, the Kansas Citizens for Science, were allowed 2 weeks to bring in all their experts to counter anything we said. Well, everything we said was right out of the journals, and we didn't mention the term intelligent design. We didn't mention God. It was just the science. There's no science that says life started from rocks, from scratch, from minerals. So they had 2 weeks to bring in everybody, and they would have to be refuting all the data in the peer-reviewed journals. Well, they decided that they would lose that battle, as Walter said. When it comes to actually debating in the public, they decided they would lose. So they boycotted it and went to the press and told them, we're boycotting this effort to teach religion in the schools. They just flipped it around and made it into a political football. Well, the State Board of Education looked at all the scientific evidence that was presented in front of them for that first week and had no evidence against it, and they changed their charter of how they teach K through 12 science. It now left it open for a teacher to bring in other materials other than the prescribed textbook that says somehow life started on this planet, and it had to be from nature, and it couldn't be from anything else. They could bring in evidence that shows that there isn't a natural force that starts life on this planet, because there is none. So they were teaching that for the next 2 years, that they could expand K through 12 and look at all the evidence. Within 2 years, the Kansas Citizens for Science got more of their people elected into the State Board of Education, and then they voted to rescind all that wording and put it back to what it was in the past. You must teach out of the textbook and nothing else. That's called how you get a corner in the market. You do it politically. You forget about science.
And that was really, that was the only breakthrough, really, wasn't it? I mean, there hasn't been any other. I mean, in terms of across the country, science, quote unquote, is predetermined, right?
Yes.
Yeah. How can a good scientist, you know, go along with this, say, well, this is, yeah, we wouldn't do this in any other field, in any other discipline. We would expect to test theories and hypotheses and things. I mean, that clearly this is, as you said, the courts are settling science now.
Yeah, unfortunately. I think creationists have noticed an interesting behavior amongst evolutionists. It's a key part of the illusion that evolutionists have. It's as if evolutionists are saying this. They don't actually say it, but it's as if they say this. So you've got an evolutionary specialist who specializes in some field, and he'll, in effect, say this. Gee, the evidence for evolution in my field is not very good. But the evidence in that other guy's field is great for evolution, right? And they all seem to be saying that. It's like all of them have an empty case, but they believe that the other fellow has a great case for evolution. And that's part of the illusion that evolutionists are relying on. If you dig into the details, you see that really all these fields, paleontology, population genetics, cosmology, origin of life, they all favor creation. But we just have to get the word out. Okay, we have to organize better. We're going to have to put on political pressure, unfortunately. We're going to have to put on political pressure for evolutionists to scientifically address the issues. Unfortunately, that's how they play the game. I'm afraid to say that. I don't like using politics in science, but to get evolutionists to address the issues, you have to apply some political pressure. I'm sad to say that's how they play the game.
And that political pressure boils right down to publishing anything in science. For instance, one of my colleagues at Northwestern was publishing a paper on their personal research, and the editor of the journal sent it back and said to the researcher, "Well, this is good. Everything else is good about the paper. We'll publish this, but you, in your conclusions, you did not give the evolutionary significance." See, every paper, that's the politics of it. So they wrote back and said, "Well, there is no evolutionary significance to this." Mm-hmm. And literally wrote that. So the evolutionary significance of this is unknown. And then they published it. As long as you said something, mm-hmm. you have to say evolution in your paper. See, that's the mm-hmm. politics of, mm-hmm. and then the next thing that's touted is that, well, everybody is publishing about evolution about all their work. It covers all areas of science because we won't publish unless you say the word evolution one way or another.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Bruce Samatt, Associate Professor of Biology at the University of Northwestern. Walter Remine, engineer, mathematician. He's author of the book, The Biotic Message, looking at the arguments, the evolutionist arguments, and sort of using them against them. You can find out more of his writings at stpaulscience.com, stpaulscience.com. We're going to continue here on Connecting Faith with more with Walter and Bruce in just a moment. You're listening to Connecting Faith. We've been having a great discussion today as we talk about, we're going to say evolutionary science, but it seems the more we've talked, the less science seems to be involved in it. But talking today with Walter Remine, who's an electrical engineer, a mathematician. He's written a book called The Biotic Message, and it uses arguments against evolutionary theory by actually using the evolutionist's own words and in plans and purposes, looking at how we can look at creation theory and take its place. Bruce Samatt, Dr. Bruce Samatt is Associate Professor of Biology at the University of Northwestern with us today. And as we talk about what doesn't seem to be working for the evolutionists, Walter, I was just thinking one of the things that seems like it's been at the cornerstone of evolutionary theory since Darwin was natural selection, right? That we're not doing so well there, though, either, are we?
Right. Natural selection is coming under fire from evolutionists. There is a substantial faction of leading evolutionists who are saying loudly that natural selection is not sufficient at explaining explaining life. In fact, some of them are saying it has only a minor role to play, and something else must be operating. And they're writing about this, publishing books about this, and it's quite the opposite of what our national science standards say. Our national science standards say that natural selection is a sufficient explanation of higher life forms, and these other leading evolutionists are saying no.
But the problem, right, is that if just one little thing goes wrong, right, life derails.
That's true. We see that especially in embryology, that if you have anything going wrong with an organism right after conception, when it goes through its first cell divisions, mm-hmm. any disruption of that affects the entire organism. And we see it all the time, and we give a name to every syndrome when there's been a developmental problem that is not under strict control.
And yet, that's at the heart of natural selection, right? That the bad things fall off, the good things will advance. Right?
Well, there was even a theory, and it's still out there, but it's really, it doesn't hold water anymore. No one really wants to stand on it, but it was the hopeful monster, mm-hmm. where, in fact, you have mutations occurring during development that gave a very different organism coming out. That fell apart everywhere, and evolutionists are not proposing that kind of many mutations happening at once because it's so disruptive. When one is, more just don't help you.
I'm interested, I guess, in, we've talked, the theory of evolution continues to degrade. There's been amazing progress, isn't there, in the last, mm-hmm. since, I don't know, Walter, is mm-hmm. it, what, 25, 30 years,
yes.
kind of since you've been working on this?
Oh, yes.
It seems like it's, every day or every week or every
yeah.
month.
Yeah. It's creation has made amazing progress. I don't think it's getting the credit it deserves. Again, not just in the origin of life, cosmology, the simplest life forms, now that we understand them, they're like incredibly complex machines. There are videos out there now you really ought to see showing the complexity of the simplest cell. It's amazing machine-like operation going on. The fossil record supports creation. Genetics, on and on. I'm very thrilled about it. And maybe I can mention message theory a little bit. I have a theory to replace evolution. Mm. And it's quite a theory. I'm very excited about it. I can give you the theory very simply. Things were designed for life, to support life. So the designs that we see in life forms are for survival, for example. But also the designs we see in the universe support life also. The second part of the theory is that life designs were to look like the designs came from one designer rather than multiple designers acting separately. And so there's a unity to life, to the universe, to the solar system, and so on.
And if you look at the natural progression of such a thing, you wouldn't expect one type of engineer having done all that.
Yeah. And the third part of the theory is even more interesting, that life was designed for those first two goals, but it was also simultaneously designed to serve another purpose, which is where a lot of the interest comes from. Life was designed to resist all evolutionary explanations. And I mean that. I'm talking about macroevolutionary explanations, the whole Megilla of naturalism. Life and the universe and the Earth and the solar system were designed to resist their explanations, and I mean that fully. I am not kidding.
Because it's so
right.
clear?
Right. Yeah. Well, life was designed to resist all these explanations, okay. and there's a lot of them. There's so many evolutionary explanations you can imagine, such as an incomplete fossil record, hopeful monsters, life came from outer space, aliens did it, multiple designers did it independently. You can go on and on. In other words, make a list of all the explanations you can think of, and then think of ways of how to defeat them all, okay, and leave one standing. One designer did it. It's not evolution. It's not naturalism. One and only one designer did it. Okay.
What would you recommend for us to... You know, as we have heard the conversation, where should we look to maybe where do you look to see God's handiwork in what maybe continues to, you know, amaze and help you marvel at the good creation of, you know, God?
Well, when I'm teaching biochemistry, for instance, we have hundreds of pathways, hundreds and hundreds. In fact, I would call them thousands of pathways that all of our organs and cells in the organs have to follow to keep and maintain life. The complexity of the entire organism, take a human if you wish, but of all the organs and all of the complexity of, and then each of the cells meeting the need of that organ, is so fantastic. The evolutionary theory says the DNA started from nothing and somehow, that's a quote, somehow developed into this perfect DNA code that has four digits in it. It has it's a four-digit code. Now, the best that humans have ever designed is a two-digit code for a computer, which are zeros and ones, zeros and ones, zero, zero, one, one, and put it together every which way, and we end up with a computer saying, dig me, I made a computer. And now we have a DNA code that has ACGT, four letters, and we say, that was spontaneous with no help. See, you don't need a designer for a four-digit code, which then has to be controlled so much more than a two-digit computer code, and we can't control computers. And in fact, when we have a mutation in a computer, we call it a hack or a virus, we see all kinds of disruptions. But in a four-digit code, which is so much more complex, we see also a mutation causes, like a hack, it causes a problem. So we have this hugely complex DNA that is under so many different levels of control because it's so complex. And we see it in the biochemistry output of all these proteins and lipids and carbohydrates, and the RNAs and the DNAs all have to work in concert, or nothing works at all.
which, Walter, is kind of what you were addressing, right? I mean, it's the concert. There are so many pieces to the orchestra, and they're all tuned to one instrument, right? To one conductor.
Yeah, we see that all life came from one source. Evolutionists say it's common ancestor. We say it's common designer. It's one designer did it.
When you look at, God's handiwork, is there an area that you sort of keep coming back to and say, you know, this is the clear presentation to me that, God knew what he was doing, that design has taken place here.
So. Wow. There's so many. I can't name them. I've been thinking lately about some simple things like, gee, the clouds are up there. They're not down here. Isn't that great? I'm so glad the clouds aren't down here. Yeah. It's pretty cool that the world was designed that way, and it's not necessary for life, really. Life would have survived if the clouds were down here, but I prefer that they're up there, and I'm glad that they are, and I'm amazed by things like that. That there's rocks. Isn't that simple? There's rocks. There's dry land. I'm glad for that. It's pretty convenient. Makes life pretty nice, pretty convenient. But there's a lot of simple things like that that we overlook that we can appreciate if we think about them. The earth is just an amazing, amazing place. Let me add another one, interesting one. To know that evolution didn't happen, you have to have fossils. You have to have fossils there that show that the ancestors aren't there. Isn't it? This kind of jogs the mind a little bit. But to show that the ancestors aren't there, you need fossils. You need a fossil record. But think about this. All these fossils are up on land. Think about that for a moment. These are sedimentary fossils laid down by water. These are marine organisms who lived in water. Most of the fossil record is marine organisms, clams and lobsters and trilobites, things like that. And yet, here's this fossil record up on land. Think about that. That's a spooky thought when you think in terms of message theory, which I've been talking about. This is a sign to show you, here's the fossils, you can see them, and the ancestors are not there. The evidence for evolution isn't there. The fossils are up on land. That's an amazingly strange behavior for a planet. Very strange behavior for a planet. This planet is designed.
And it seems that, and the fossil record has shown that the same fossils are found on all continents around the Earth and at the same depth. So they all lived at the same time, and then there was something that buried them all. And they had been aquatic. So, was there a flood? I pose the question.
I love what you talked about, Bruce, a little bit ago, that the evolutionists use the word somehow. We talk about somehow, and as Walter said, the evidence isn't there. And I think those are two words that you don't like to really use in science. But it clearly is the case as we've done a little dissection of evolution today and talking creation. Our time is gone. I want to just quickly remind you, you can find out more about Walter's book and writings at the website stpaulscience.com. stpaulscience.com, Walter Remine, engineer, mathematician. Otherwise, Discovery Institute probably would be a good place to recommend. Explore Evolution is the textbook that Bruce was recommending. It would be easy enough for, I think, anyone to understand the argument for and against the neo-Darwinism. You can get that through the Discovery Institute. That's a great resource as well. Bruce Samatt, the associate professor of biology. Walter Remine, author of The Biotic Message, and engineer and mathematician. Gentlemen, thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Connecting Faith. If you missed part of today's show, you want to pass it on to a friend, we certainly recommend that. Go to our website, myfaithradio.com, and click on Connecting Faith.